Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Kimberly Atkins in for Meghna Chakravarti, and this is On Point. In 1987, Jason DeParo was a young American reporter studying poverty in the Philippines. Through a bit of good luck, he managed to embed himself with a family living in a rundown shack in a shantytown built on a Manila mudflat. That good fortune turned into 30-plus years of friendship as he followed three generations of this one family for a story that tells both the larger picture of global migration from Manila to the Persian Gulf to the United States and a more intimate look at what it means to become American. Jason DeParo is out with a new book, and he joins us this hour on Point, Global Migration and One Family Story. And you can join us. Is this tale of migration your story, too? What experiences did you have along the way? Join us anytime on Point Radio or on Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined now by Jason DeParo. He's a reporter for The New York Times covering poverty and immigration. His new book is A Good Provider is One Who Leaves, One Family and Migration in the 21st Century. You can find a link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us from Washington. Jason, thanks for being here today.
Hi, Kimberly. Good to be with you.
So I want to start out by saying, before we dive into this story in your book, when you started, when you first went to the Philippines all those years ago, did you have the slightest idea that all these years later, it would produce a story right in the middle of a major immigration debate that we're having, not just nationally, but internationally?
I didn't even have migration in mind. I went to the Philippines because I was interested in slum life in the developing world, and I wound up moving in with a family, and it turned out that migration was how they survived. The father of the family was a guest worker in Saudi Arabia, and the mom was home raising their five children on the money he sent back. Over the years, all five of those children grew up and became overseas workers like the father. So it was really only with the passage of time that I came to appreciate how important migration was to them and then, of course, to the world at large.
So let's go back to that time when you were a young reporter going to cover poverty, as you said, and tell us about meeting this family and what was it about them that gave you an inkling that you would stay in touch for the years to come?
You know, I went to approach a nun who lived and worked in this shantytown and to try to persuade her to approach a family on my behalf. She was a little reluctant, but she finally agreed told me to come back in a few days. I thought, of course, she would use the intervening time to discreetly raise the issue. And instead, she grabbed me by the hand and led me through the alleys and auctioned me off on the spot to the first family that she found. So the first woman, you know, I knew just enough Tagalog to understand this woman was horrified and said, no, sister, it's not possible. And the second woman said the same thing. And the third woman was just too frightened to speak. Sister Christine had lost her patience by then and stomped off and said, if you don't want him, pass him on to someone else and don't cook him anything special. If he gets sick too bad, and left me in this frightened woman staring at each other. I don't know which one of us was more frightened. And she eventually gave in to what she thought was Sister Christine's wish or to let me move in. And out of that, a lifelong friendship developed.
Wow. So tell us.
But you asked whether I thought I'd be in touch. You know, I didn't know if I'd be there for a day, 2 days, if I'd be there at all. I mean, neither of us had any idea of what the plan was. There was no plan.
So you say you began this story with your quest to look into poverty. But it seems from your description very quickly, the idea of migration was an integral part of that. It seems that this is one example, and I'm sure there are many, where poverty and migration go hand in hand.
The oldest daughter in the family was born with a congenital heart defect and needed medicine and medical attention that the father couldn't afford. And at one point, after years of worrying over his daughter, he dropped to his knees and asked God, either take her with you up in heaven or let me have her. This was his prayer. You know, cure, help me help her or take her away. And God answered in a mysterious way a few days later with a job offer in Saudi Arabia at 10 times what the father, my friend Emmett, was making in Manila. So it would mean being apart from his family for 2 years, living in an Islamic autocracy where stories of abused workers are rife, but it would multiply his family's income tenfold. So it economically began the long lift and transformation of this family into the middle class.
Yeah, you're anticipating my question because I was saying another theme in this book is how hard. No, it's great. I appreciate it. A big theme in this book is how hard the members of this family worked in order to care for themselves and each other, and how difficult finding opportunities can be. I mean, they literally went around the world, as you noticed, looking for opportunities, and these opportunities were often really tough, grueling jobs. Talk a little bit more about that.
The first generation, the book tells the story of three generations. So the Emmett, the father, was the part of the first generation. It was largely men going abroad to the Persian Gulf, particularly Saudi Arabia. In the wake of the 1973 oil embargo, the Persian Gulf countries were rich with petrodollars and short on workers, and they needed big building projects. They were building roads and airports and hospitals and bridges, and the men went and did a lot of heavy construction work. In the second generation, which the main character of the book is Emmett's daughter, Rosalie, migration feminized, and the women who the migrants who were going abroad, particularly from the Philippines, were largely women going to do often caretaking jobs, domestic workers, nursing aides. So the nature of the work changed and the migration changed.
And talk a little bit about Rosalie, who, as you say, is a main character in this book. And the book really gives us an opportunity to see this process, this migration process through her eyes. And I want to make clear, this was a legal migration process. These folks did not seek asylum. It was not a legal immigration. It was them seeking out legally job based on the jobs that were available. Talk a little, introduce our listeners to Rosalie.
Rosalie. Rosalie was 15 years old when I moved in to the shantytown. She's now a 48-year-old mother of three and a registered nurse in Texas. If you were going to look around the shantytown where 15,000 people lived and pick the teenager who would be most likely to escape the poverty there, you probably wouldn't have picked Rosalie. She was very shy. She had no particular academic progress. She promised. She was a sort of CB student. The thing that revealed Rosalie's character to me on her high school transcript wasn't her grades. It was her attendance. In 4 years of literal revolution and poverty, constant poverty in the Philippines, she never missed a day of class. Over time, she told me later on, about high school was when I got grit. She's a 4'11" Filipino nurse who would be the last person in the room you would tend to notice, and she has an enormous amount of resilience and strength. It took her 20 years to get to the States. An enormous amount of perseverance. You know, she's worked in the Persian Gulf for 15 years, took the American nursing test 3 times, the English test 5 times. She just kept going. Sorry, North.
No. I appreciate you telling us about this in her story, and I want to continue to talk more about Rosalie. But before we go to a break in a few minutes, I want to sort of pull this back big picture, because we're having this discussion at a time where, as I said, immigration is at the fore, particularly going into an election year. We've heard a lot about the desire by the current presidential administration to limit not just illegal immigration, but also legal immigration and migration. What do you think our listeners could learn from this story to give them a better idea about migration as it is demonstrated by this family?
Well, two things. I think the narrative right now is being dominated by discussions of illegal immigration, unauthorized immigration, and the crisis at the border. Hugely important issues. But 3/4 of the immigrants in the United States are here legally, as Rosalie is. And secondly, I think President Trump presents immigration as a narrative of threat, that immigrants are a threat to our jobs, our fiscal budgets, our public health, our national security. And Rosalie didn't take an American job. She was recruited by an American hospital to fill a job it couldn't fill. A hurricane hit Galveston, Texas, closed down the hospital, and the hospital spent years trying to lure nurses, enough nurses, back onto the hospital to back onto the island to fully rebuild the hospital. And only after years of frustration when it couldn't find enough nurses did it recruit abroad. So she was one of 20 foreign nurses that came in and helped provide health care, improve the medical care of the community. In 3 years, her children not only learned English, lost Tagalog, wound up on the honor roll. They bought a house in the suburbs. There's a narrative in America, I think, that assimilation no longer works, that immigrants don't want to assimilate. Well, Rosalie and her family achieved in 3 years a degree of assimilation that used to take three generations, you know, with a house in the suburbs and kids on the honor roll. So no family can embody 44 million different immigration stories in the country. But I think hers embodies the story of immigration missing from the Trump Twitter feed.
And she is now seeking citizenship. Is that correct?
She is. Yep. Yeah, she's driving around Texas with civics tapes playing on her. I got in the car, went to see her not long ago, and got in the car, and turns on the engine, and you hear this: "Who is the father of the country? what did Abraham Lincoln do?"
All right. We are talking about global migration with reporter and author Jason DeParle. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in this one family story? How have President Trump's new policies on immigration changed the way you look at both illegal and legal migration? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're discussing one family's story of migration from a slum in the Philippines to a Houston suburb. You can join the conversation. How is President Trump affecting our national conversation on immigration? What should we do differently as a country? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking to Jason DeParle. He's a New York Times reporter and author of the new book, A Good Provider is One Who Leaves, One Family and Migration in the 21st Century. Jason, thanks for sticking with us. I want to start this segment with a little bit of sound from the president. Last May in the Rose Garden, President Trump spoke about immigration. In regards to legal immigration, President Trump said America needed to change the system so more high-skill workers can come to America.
As a result of our broken rules, the annual green card flow is mostly low wage and low skilled. Newcomers compete for jobs against the most vulnerable Americans and put pressure on our social safety net and generous welfare programs. Only 12% of legal immigrants are selected based on skill or based on merit. In countries like Canada, Australia and New Zealand, and others, That number is closer to 60 and even 70 and 75% in some cases.
So, Jason, the president is painting this picture of an immigration process that puts American-born working-class people at risk. But as you said, in this case, Rosalie, for example, moved to Galveston, Texas, to fill jobs that were urgently needed that weren't being filled by Americans.
Yeah, I think there's a legitimate debate to be had about what kinds of immigrants what mix of immigrant skills we need in the country. And that's a perfectly legitimate thing for America to be debating. I think where I'm troubled more by the president's rhetoric is when he talks about immigrants as terrorists, as criminals, as dangers to our communities, as people, you know, during the campaign, he recited a parable of what he called immigrant treachery, called the snake, you know, where he likened refugees to snakes who would turn around and bite the hand that feed them. I don't think, you know, the danger to assimilation, I think, doesn't come from a debate about what skill mix of immigrants we have in the country. It comes from a message that immigrants aren't welcome.
And I want you to talk a little bit about the remittance money that migrants send home globally when they come here. That sort of refers to the title of your book a bit, if you want to, about taking care of your family, having to leave to go somewhere else in order to do it. Your light bulb moment was when you realized the amount of money that was sent home. Talk a little bit more about that.
The combined remittances, the amount that migrants send back to their families, is three times the world's foreign aid budgets combined.
Wow.
So, migration is the world's largest anti-poverty program. If you go back to Rosalie and her family, she was born in a shanty that didn't even have running water. And because her father went abroad and made 10 times his Philippine salary, she was able to afford, if just barely, to go to nursing school, and then worked 15 years in the Persian Gulf and was able to get to Texas and buy a 4-bedroom home in the Houston suburbs. I've spent nearly 44 decades covering poverty, and I've never seen a more successful escape from poverty. It's the most impressive anti-poverty story I know.
I want to go to our callers. Wayne is calling from Carver, Massachusetts. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm good.
Good. I want to talk a little bit about immigrants. I was raised by an immigrant from Ireland. Her name was Helen Collins. She came out to this country on the next boat out from the Titanic. She arrived in New York and ended up in Dorchester, where some of her family was. However, before she came to this country, she only had a third grade education. She taught herself to read behind the barn when the chores were done, as she was the oldest girl who was coming up, and the others were coming up under her. So she took care of these children in her mother's house in Ireland until she was 14. At the time of 14, her parents prepared her to come to America as a adult, fully equipped to handle business transactions and to get a job, she was to come to America to get a job, to send money back to the home in Ireland so that the family would not starve. Before she left for America, her father looked her in the face in front of the whole family, and he said to her, "Helen, when you go to America, to the land of opportunities, and you get a job, and you're making money, and if the person who gave you that job ask anything from you that is beneath your dignity, you are to quit, Helen. Quit the job and walk out. Mm. And we would just as soon die here in Ireland than to see you lose your dignity." But so what I'm focusing on is dignity and values and human worth. Here was a family that was willing to starve to death through hunger than to see their child do anything that was beneath her dignity.
Wayne,
she went on to raise 10 children, and then she took 150 state children for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, foster children, and raised them.
Wayne, I really appreciate your call and for sharing that story. I want to give Jason a chance to react to it.
Kyle, there was a lot in that comment. One thing that prompts a thought is Wayne said that the woman who raised him had a third grade education. I think it goes back to your earlier question about what kind of immigrants should we have. Proponents of high skilled immigration often use the word merit. But merit comes in a lot of different forms, as it did with – it's not always education or technical skills, and as it obviously did for this woman, and it did for Rosalie. If you were – as I said earlier, if you were to look around and said who had the most, quote, merit or the most economic promise in when she was a teenager, it wouldn't have been her.
Mm. So I want to hit on another word that comes up a lot in the immigration debate, and that is assimilation. It's a controversial term that means different things to different people. But as you mentioned earlier, this idea that immigrants have a difficult time assimilating in America, you found that not to be the case necessarily with Rosalie, and certainly not with her children. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think there is a critique of immigration largely from the right that holds that immigrants don't really want to be American. They don't want to adopt. They're not adopting our civic values. They don't learn our history. They don't. They're not patriotic. So let me tell you a story. Rosalie and her kids were up and this weekend with me, and we went to the Lincoln Memorial, and her daughters, who are 16 and 13, stood on the steps where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech and were able to articulate that Abraham Lincoln had freed the slaves, but they weren't really free, these little girls said, because they weren't treated equally. And then Martin Luther King gave a speech 50 years ago about making them fully free. And then they said, we as immigrants have inherited the benefits of that. We're the ones who benefit because thanks to Abraham Lincoln and to Martin Luther King, the country is more free or more open to people of all colors now.
Mm.
If that's not assimilation, my God, what more would you want of a civics lesson would you want from young immigrants? I think American culture is a powerfully assimilative force, and that immigrant parents often have a hard time, try sometimes to keep it away from their children because they Rosalie was determined that her kids would keep speaking Tagalog, and she couldn't preserve that in a country where English is so powerful. The kids forgot how to speak Tagalog.
Oh, wow. So she tried to have a home, at least at home, where
we will only speak Tagalog in the family and that in the household. And that, that lasted, a week. I mean, American culture was pouring in their pockets, on their cell phones, in their schools, pop culture, whether it was stories about civil rights heroes at school or Hannah Montana at home. I mean, you couldn't keep American culture away from them.
Wow. Okay, so Melanie is calling from Lake Worth, Florida. Hi, Melanie.
Hello. I was calling because Rosalie's story really resonated with my own. My family moved from Argentina after the 2001 crisis to the United States. I was 10 years old, and we had to wait 10 years to become legal residents of the United States, which was a long time. And when it came time to apply for college, I did not qualify for things like aid from the state or from the nation because I wasn't a legal resident yet, even though I was here legally. So I had to apply for only private scholarship, but I did graduate as a music teacher with no student debt from university. And I just think I just wanted to share that story because I also, 4 years ago, I became a citizen as well. And I just think it's true that there are many immigrants who come and try to do things the right way and just love this country so much and the opportunity that it provides.
Melanie, thank you for the call. Jason, what do you think policymakers can learn from stories like Melanie's, stories like Rosalie's, as they craft? I mean, I think everyone would agree that immigration policy needs to be reformed in this country. There is disagreement about how to do that. What do you think the policymakers could learn from these stories when they're deciding what to do about immigration?
There's a critique out there that immigration is too easy. I think Melanie was sort of referring to that, how hard her family had to work and persevere to be here. You know, going back to Rosalie's story, 20 years. Most of the immigrants who come here have made a decision that they really want to be here and have worked hard to get here, whether however they've come. I think that's missing from the debate.
Okay, and we talked a little bit about values in our last hour, what it means to be an American. We heard Melanie saying how proud she is to be an American, despite how long it's taken and all the work. In talking to Rosalie and members of her family, what did you glean about their values? What it is that makes them want to, after traveling, you know, all over the world to work and now being in the United States, wanting to seek citizenship and listen to those tapes in the car? What values did they express to you?
It's often discussed as though you have to choose between being, say, Filipino or American. You know, Stephen Miller, the president's immigration advisor, in his high school yearbook, quoted Theodore Roosevelt saying there can be no such thing as a hyphenated American. Right. So this is a notion that you have to choose. You're either one or the other. What I found in this family is that they have blended their two cultures in ways that are really creative and helpful and success and making them successful. So the little girl, Laura, who was 7 when she came, gets from her Filipino side her religious faith, her polite manners, her family values. And from American side, she gets curiosity. She gets a sense of fewer gender constraints, a sense of racial equality. Mm. Can I tell you a quick story about Rosa Parks and Laura?
Yes.
So Laura, the first year she comes, she's, again, 7 years old. She goes in the second grade, and their teacher tells her Rosa Parks is a hero. And Laura is baffled because Rosa Parks got arrested. And a little girl from the Philippines doesn't understand how somebody who gets arrested could be a hero. You know, she's taught to be obedient and respect authority. So the second year, Black History Month rolls around again, and Laura says one night at dinner table, apropos of nothing, you know, I kind of agree with Rosa Parks. And I looked at her and I said, well, tell me more. Well, it wasn't fair for her to sit in the back of the bus. So now she's going from her, like, Filipino values, obedience to authority, to American values, you know, equality. And then she adds this little Filipino twist. She says, and the really interesting thing is when Rosa Parks got arrested, she didn't curse at the policeman. She was polite. So she gives it that little Filipino, you know, she stood up for equality, but she did it politely. I thought it was a brilliant a mix of two cultures.
And yeah.
A great example of how immigrants absorb American civics lessons and then and add to them, enrich them as well.
I want to get another call in before we go to break. Bob is on the line from Annapolis, Maryland. Hi there, Bob.
Hi. I just want to go ahead and add on to the Rosalind family. I was married to a Peruvian for 27 years. She first came over. We got married. And what she did, she only had like 2 relatives living here first. Boom, using the Chang family migration, she got more family members living here than I have. And what all those family members did was help this community out. They worked jobs. They brought they brought money to the place. They meant this community so much better. And the most important thing they brought, too, is children. There are so many children now going there, good children, going to school and all that. What my wife did and the Peruvian folks that came up made America better. Thank goodness.
All right, Jason, what's your reaction?
you hear lots of stories like that. Yeah, obviously, I think that immigration is on balance, on the whole, good for America. I don't think it means that all immigration – because immigration is good for America doesn't mean all immigration in every form is always good. I think there's, as I said, plenty of room for debate about what kinds of immigrants we want, how many we want, under what circumstances they come. What I really fear about the last few years is that the conversation has turned so rancorous that we are sending a signal that immigrants aren't wanted, and we may wind up with the failures of assimilation that we pretend we fear.
And when we come back from break,
self-fulfilling prophecy. Excuse me. Yeah.
Sure. And when we come from the break, I want to hear more from you about how the rancorous debate affects people like Rosalie and her family. So we will do that as soon as we get back from the break. We're talking to Jason DeParle, a New York Times reporter and author of the book "A Good Provider: One Who Leaves." A good provider is one who leaves one family and migration in the 21st century. You can join the conversation. What's been your experience with migration? Are you sending money back home to a family or a foreign country? How have you adjusted to life in another country? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're discussing one family story of migration from a slum in the Philippines to a Texas suburb. You can join the conversation. What questions do you have for my guest, Jason DeParle, who is the author of a new book, A Good Provider is One Who Leaves, One Family and Migration in the 21st Century? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. So, Jason, we were talking a little bit about the debate on immigration and how it can be rancorous. You mentioned earlier Stephen Miller, who is President Trump's senior policy advisor and is a key force in Trump administration immigration and migration policy. A week after President Trump posted racist tweets about four minority Democratic Congresswomen known as the Squad, Stephen Miller went on Fox News Sunday. He said, "The Democratic Congresswomen will destroy America with their immigration policies." Let's listen.
"These four Congresswomen detest America as it exists, as it is currently constructed. They want to tear down the structure of our country. They want it to be a socialist open borders country. If you, as Donald Trump says, want to destroy America with open borders, you cannot say you love your country. If you attack border agents the way that Ocasio-Cortez has, it means you have a deep-seated hatred of the nation as it exists. That's why you want to erase its borders, fundamentally transform the country, and in the process, it doesn't matter if American citizens lose their jobs, lose their homes, lose their livelihoods, lose their health coverage, and lose their very lives."
That's White House senior policy advisor Stephen Miller. Jason, how does the debate, which can get very divisive, over immigration affect families like Rosalie? How does it affect their feeling about being in America and where America is headed?
Kimberly, you know, for just a second, to go back to what we've had three callers, one telling a story from Ireland about somebody who really wanted to come, one from Argentina, one from Peru. And all, what those three stories all had in common was a sense that coming to America was the fulfillment of their greatest dreams. And that's what Rosalie's story was. And I think it's good for your country to be the place where people go to have their dreams come true. I think that enriches our country. I think that makes us a more optimistic place. You know, I think we all benefit from having people like that among us. And that is the story that that's Rosalie's story. That's the story I tell. And it's the story that your listeners have told in their own different ways. And it's a story just so at odds with the clip that you just played about immigration stealing people's lives and stealing people's jobs and stealing and taking and hurting and harming. Just not what I saw at all.
Okay, I want to go back to our phones. Edgar is calling from Dayton, Ohio. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Edgar,
hello?
Yes, you're on, Edgar. Go ahead.
Yes, so my comment is a bit twofold. I'm Shawnee and Miami American Indian, and I'm also Scotch-Irish and German-Italian. So I've managed, as a result of my parents being naturalized citizens, to have served my country and can maintain a good job. But due to migration and immigration that was out of control, which happened, of course, when Western cultures came to the Americas, they obliterated, for the most part, the indigenous cultures that were here, and as a result, they are also the most impoverished community remaining in the United States. I'm all for immigration because I'm a result of it. Mm-hmm. However, I see how destructive it can be if it's out of control. So I'll take my comment offline.
Yeah, Jason, I mean, you talked earlier that this is complex, that there is room for debate, and there is a lot in American history when it comes to the effects of immigration.
Well, the caller used the word control. I think that's an important word. I think people do get afraid when they perceive that immigration is out of control. And governments that fail to take control lose credibility. I think you've seen that in Europe. I think you've seen that in the United States. I think it's a problem for democratic governments. They need to convey to their citizens that there's an orderly system, and they need to do that in order to keep support for all the good things that immigration can bring.
Kathleen is calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on with Jason DePearl.
Hello, Jason and everyone listening. I just wanted to add, I am the daughter of an immigrant who immigrated from the Dominican Republic, waited 7 years to get approved to come to the country, became a single mom and bought her home on her own, never took any type of assistance, and figured out that this country does offer a lot of promises, but we do have to work very hard. With that said, we were born here, my brother and I, in New York, and we always try to focus on keeping a part of our identity related tightly to our culture. And I only say that because I know it's hard for Americans to sometimes assume you can just grow up within your culture and just totally become Americanized. Just totally forget about your culture, your music, your heritage. And that's kind of hard to say when once we do that, and I do mean that for multiple cultures that are within the Latino culture, because people sometimes think, oh, they all think alike. And it's a plethora of different little pockets of cultures, South Americans, Spaniards, you have Caribbean Latinos. And it's very difficult to grow up, learn the values, learn the culture, and then turn around, become a citizen, and just totally drop that. Latinos that do that really get affected, because they notice that once they do become citizens and Americanized, America's not always treating them like an American. You are still part of those people.
Yeah, Kathleen, I appreciate that call, and I want to talk to Jason a little bit more about this idea of assimilation and both the positive and negative aspects of that, as she pointed out. I mean, Jason, we're a country, we don't have a national language, is a country that, I grew up learning that this was a melting pot. How does that idea sort of reconcile with this need, as so many people focus on, for assimilation?
Well, we were talking before about the comment by Theodore Roosevelt at the peak of the Ellis Island immigration that there's no such thing as a hyphenated American. Mm-hmm. And there was a retort by the great educator John Dewey at the time that said, of course, they're hyphenated Americans, but the point is to see that the hyphen connects rather than separates. Mm-hmm. I think of that as a great way to think about assimilation. Of course, people who come from another culture are going to another country and another culture, they're going to retain their language, they're going to retain their religion, they're going to retain their music, their food. Those things don't separate us. The point is to help them connect to American culture. It's always been Italian American. Have you ever seen a "Kiss Me, I'm Irish" button? I mean, you know, throughout our history, we have blended cultures. So the point isn't that you forget where you came from or that you somehow remembering your Filipino language, your Filipino life, your Filipino history. The point is that you open up to American, that you learn English, that you open up to American values. And the two are always a mix. We've never really been a melting pot in the sense that we if you take that metaphor strictly, that we're going to lose what we brought with us. It's always been more of a hybrid process.
Jason, I want to ask you, as you said, you met this family more than three decades ago, and you didn't know then that it would lead to this story. But what was it that made you realize you had a story that you wanted to tell in this way? Why did you write this
book? It had nothing to do with
now?
Migration, to tell you the truth. Hmm. It was the character of this family, that they had endured great material deprivation and growing up in a shanty town with no running water and not enough food to eat. And yet they had, I guess, a grace is the best word I can think of for it, a strong religious faith, great parental devotion to the children, great reverence for the parents from the children, a hard work ethic, a really generous spirit to me who just showed up on their doorstep, humor, curiosity. I was drawn to their spirit long before I understood that their spirit was going to turn them into a family of international migrants.
All right. I want to get a couple more calls in. Claudia is calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Claudia.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good.
Yep. Hi. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of my input. So I am an immigrant, and I came here as a, what you call a twin. I finished high school. I graduated college. I worked all the way to college. I hardly have any loans because I used to pay for my own classes, mm-hmm. basically. So, see, I feel like I'm more American than Latino, but this is the point that I want to make. I am proud of my roots, and I teach my children my language and my culture. So, as an immigrant, I think that we bring more positive than negative. And right now, media and everyone else from Trump, from Fox News, from anyone in the media team, they are kind of
Claudia, I'm only interrupting because you're breaking up a little bit, but I get your point that for you, migration has been a positive thing more than a negative thing, and I appreciate your call. Liz is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Hi there, Liz.
Hi. I was just calling because I've never called in before, but I was just really moved listening to some of these stories, and I just wanted to share that when my great-grandmother emigrated from Czechoslovakia in the early 1900s, she came with just her mother and just the things they could carry. And when they sailed, I guess, into New York, they ended up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. But on their way getting there, they ended up staying with strangers and people who just helped them along the way and fed them and sheltered them for the evening. And, you know, it's just so different to think of that kind of welcoming environment compared to how we kind of talk about immigration today in the current political climate.
Thank you for that call, Liz.
Kimberly, can I jump in there
yes,
for just
please.
A second? The welcoming environment. One thing we were talking about how what a rancorous political environment we live in. One thing I took away from the story was that at the lived level, daily life, immigration is less divisive than it is in national politics. So this family moved to Metro Houston, which you may be surprised to learn is the most ethnically diverse metro area in the country, you know, more than New York or L.A., Houston. When I grew up, you know, Houston was known for honky-tonks and rodeos. It's now got Hindu temples in the suburbs. It boasts Cajun hybrid cuisine. These 20 foreign nurses, I think would all say that they generally felt welcomed there. And Houston's a pro-immigration place. The Houston Chronicle is a very pro-immigrant newspaper and public opinion polls always show that 2/3 to 3/4 of Houstonians favor immigration. So I think at the level of daily life, immigration has been less contentious than, you know, our culture is better than our politics. Let me put it that way.
And you talked, and there was the kindness of strangers. The last caller put out, obviously, the kindness of strangers is where this book started. Jose is calling from Miami. Hi, Jose.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. You're on with Jason DePaul.
Hi. Yeah. Well, my comment is that we came here from El Salvador in the 70s. Actually, my parents and my brother and sister were born here. Mm-hmm. But the comment I have is just the way people struggle to get here, you know, because we're all educated, but we were all educated here. But there's some towns over there that don't have schools. You know, they can't even read or write Spanish. But, you know, not English. And they come here, they can't even read or write English. But not even knowing that they can't read or write Spanish, it's even worse for them because it's just the illiteracy they have over there. And it's sad because we had a lot of people in our church that struggle with that. And we try to help them out that with, like, literacy programs and, you know, just to get them to speak English. But I'm pro-immigration, but just to get people just to get on board, just to learn the language here, that's the biggest struggle that a lot of people have. And not to get off the beaten path, but if they, you know, if they get rid of education here, you know, put less and less money, it's going to be like El Salvador because there's no education. There's no tools, there's no resources for those people, and that's why they come here.
Thank you for that call, Jose. Jason, talk about the barriers that these folks face. I mean, you hear a lot of people saying if you want to come to the United States, you need to learn to speak and write English, but there are barriers that prevent even that.
I think the most common fear among critics of immigration is that immigrants aren't learning English, and yet the National Academy of Sciences has concluded that this generation of immigrants is learning English faster than they have in the past. By the second generation, English is virtually universal. There are a lot of things to worry about in immigration, but I don't think English acquisition is one of them. You know, one thing I'm struck by, all the people who've called in, whether they're telling stories of being immigrants themselves or immigrants in their family 3-4 generations back, it really testifies to our identity as a nation of immigrants. And yet the Trump administration went so far as to remove the phrase nation of immigrants from the mission statement of the U.S. Immigration Agency. That's when I say that our culture has welcomed immigrants more than our politics. I think that's an example.
All right, Jason DePaul, it was a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about your book.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from David Marino, Liz Nieslas, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Mm-hmm. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.